tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, why can't world leaders find the way to peace? Why must we hear only the bad news? Why all the gloomy predictions of doom and evil foreboding? Why is it that almost every newspaper you pick up talks of peace talks failing, or of threats from this government or the other, the threat of war and more war, the agonizing, dragging, festering wound that is Vietnam? Just this morning I picked up a newspaper, I took a look at it, it said again, Russians threaten this and that. I think it was talking about the escalation of the war in Vietnam, and particularly talking about Russian military support for the North Vietnamese. Now, did you ever wonder why? Did you ever wonder why it is we're living in this day, this experience where we're continually bombarded and surrounded with bad news? We've gotten to the place we think it is normal to live in abnormal times. We've gotten to the place we believe war is a sort of a normal thing. It's about us all the time. Few people realize that we've had more than 40 wars since the cessation of World War II. But my friends, we ought to know that there is such a thing as cause and effect. That there is a cause for every effect, that there is a cause of war. There is a causal factor for warfare, for crime, for all of our problems, whether those problems are personal, whether those problems are in your marriage, your pocketbook, your bank account, whether, as so many write in continually, it's a problem of personal health and sickness. Every one of these things has a cause. There's a cause of crime. There's always a cause of divorce, a reason why husband and wife are at each other's throats and why they're disenchanted with one another and they want to go off in some other direction. There is always a discernible direct cause for every one of these ills, for every one of the evils of mankind. Now, it's rather logical, I would assume, and I think you would agree it is, that there is also a cause for peace. But on the other hand, as well as there being a cause for war and for all the evil things that we see about us, there is a cause of plenty. A cause of marital happiness. A cause of personal, national, and worldwide prosperity. A cause that would produce fulfillment and joy. And the real peace and the sense of overflowing, abundant living that everybody really wants. But have you ever just sat back as if it were to watch the world go by, to take a good long arm's length look at the world and to appraise the world conditions and ask yourself, why? Why is it this way? How did it get this way? And is there any purpose to it all? Now, science says very plainly, as I've quoted in a few occasions on the World Tomorrow program of late, that it can give us no reason, no purpose in being or in existing beyond a pleasant experience one way or the other. That science, when we ask questions such as what are we, why are we, what are we doing here, what direction should our lives take, what is the purpose in human experience and existence, science gives us no answer beyond a sort of a pleasant experience. In other words, science tells us we are accidents, sort of like cosmic amoeba. We are purposeless, we're in a blind, unreasoning environment, drifting through life aimlessly. We ourselves, scientists believe, are happenstances. We are sort of accidental bits of meaningless life in a purposeless and a blind universe of chance, without cause, without program, without purpose, without sense of direction. Now, many of your lives have become exactly like that. Your lives are accidental, and you wish they weren't. You know, people don't enjoy accidents. I certainly don't. Nobody does. You don't enjoy hearing of another horrible plane crash. And especially when it comes close to home and you hear of a loved one who has been involved in an accident, whether it was just loss of property and damage to your automobile, or whether it was a fire or a drowning or something, it is deplorable and heartbreaking news. We don't like accidents. Accidents are tragedies. And accidents, my friends, are never planned. If they're planned, obviously they are not accidents. Then it's a deliberate something or other, some kind of a tragedy. Why is it so many of our lives are accidental? Why is it we swallow the idea that we are accidents and our lives ought to be accidental, that we ought to be living as happenstance occurs to us? Many of you are living in circumstances. in certain jobs, in certain areas for that matter of your country, and you're living in homes, and you're living in circumstances, your entire environment, which are purely accidental. You had no thought, no program, but a series of either fortuitous or in this case perhaps, in all too many cases, unfortunate accidents occurred to put you where you are, to make you what you are, to put you in the job and the position in which you find yourself, and so it is. So many people are living this precious period of time that is life, this wonderful experience of life that ought to be so filled with meaning and goodness and purpose and a sense of direction and to be happy and to be filled with joy, and yet they are living it aimlessly and purposelessly without direction, without sense of course, without knowing exactly where they are going, and without knowing why they're trying to get there. Now, when you stop to think about it, the whole world is doing that, isn't it? It seems to be going nowhere. The world seems to be on a treadmill. It's almost like the orbital pattern of the Earth itself. It orbits seemingly endlessly. It goes on and on and on, and the science doesn't even agree on when it all began. But the main thing is, scientists, with their evolutionary theories, and not all scientists believe in evolution, but all too many do, have no purpose for your human experience. They have no purpose for your existence. They can't offer to you an explanation for your questions. Why am I? What am I? What am I doing here? What is the purpose in my life? And where should I be going? Is there any goal that I should be busily achieving? No, science tells us instead that we are just human creatures, the result of some kind of an evolutionary process. Now, why is it we don't have newspapers filled with good news? Why is it you can't hear instead of Russians threaten to supply arms to the North Vietnamese that Russians warm up and are smiling and friendly and happy and the war is over in Vietnam, the boys are coming home, the Jewish and the Arab crises are now all solved, everybody loves everybody. Why can't we hear news like that? Why should it be denied us? Do you ever wonder why there are definite, provable, logical, simple reasons why we can't have that news yet today, and how it is that we are going to have that news in the world tomorrow? Now, it sounds a little illogical to people and almost too good to be true, but that's because we have rejected the source of the cause of peace, the cause of happiness, and the cause of the absence of war. We have wanted to reject the source, the real cause of marital success and happiness, the cause that produces every... Well, how do you say it? I don't know what words to use, whether you want to say happiness or abundance or joy or scintillating, gripping, thrilling experience, everything that tingles the spine. And you know, not all physical sensations by any means are wrong. A lot of people get the idea, for instance, when they hear a religionist talking, they think that religion says, deny yourself everything that is fun, and you live a drab, dull, gray, irksome, boring, uninteresting experience that is nothing short of wretched. And at the end of it all, if you flagellate yourself often enough, if you deprive yourself of enough, at the end of this long, difficult road to hoe, you will get some kind of a retirement for all eternity where you sort of compare wings and shuffle through harp music. A lot of people have that idea. And it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. It's not in the Bible, at any rate. I happen to know that because I know what the Bible says. A lot of people don't, but that's what I'm coming to. Now, there is a God, and you can prove it. If you are willing to come right back to the question, why no peace, then you've got to admit that the leaders in this world are what the educational institutions have made them. And the average leader today, regardless as to his religion, you and I will have to admit, does not look to an all-wise, powerful, divine, creating being who actually rules in his creation and who has a program that he's working out. These leaders don't look to find out, what is that program? How does my government fit into it? How do I fit into it personally? How can I get busy to affect and to get in harmony with that program? They just don't. We know this, don't we? There's no argument there. You wouldn't argue with me for a moment on that premise, would you? You wouldn't say that you know of government leaders who are on their knees calling out to an all-wise divine God and saying, Father in heaven, help me to know the course that I should follow by searching your word. No, you don't know of any such leaders. So, all right, that's one step. Now, The fact, then, that this world is what its leaders make it, and that this world's leaders are not seeking the cause of peace at the only source that is going to give them that cause, and the fact that you can prove that there is such an all-wise, divine, powerful, creating being who is filled with warmth, with friendliness, with long-suffering, with kindness, with goodness, with faith, with mercy, who loves you personally and individually and wants only the best things for you and for all human creatures. Now, you can prove that, and I'm going to prove it to you if you will open your minds and your ears and be willing to at least look into it. And there's no reason you shouldn't be, because it can't hurt you to investigate. It never hurt anybody to at least sort of throw up in the air his ideas and opinions and let them come down and sift through them again and look through them and find out where he got the things in which he believes. It never hurt anybody to do that. Now, there happens to be a source of knowledge that would lead us to peace, and the source of all foundational knowledge, a fundamental knowledge that tells you what you are and what this skeleton surrounded by tissue and sinew and flesh and this circulatory and nervous system, this gray matter, this palpitating heart, and these bellows that we call lungs are all about. What you as a human physical creature are doing on this earth. There is only one source to which you can go to find out, and science gives you no answer. The philosophy textbooks don't give you an answer. There isn't a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a philosopher who remotely knows, and every one of them admit they do not know. They do not know, and they tell you that. They don't know the answer. They rather cheerfully admit it. I do know the answer. I know what I'm doing here. I know what you're doing here, and you can find out, and I'm not bragging. No, I'm not at all. That's by a great, merciful act of tremendous long-suffering that I happen to know that, because it's something that has been revealed and given as a great gift, and not something that I have earned or worked for or in any way achieved. And you can have it, that same gift, if you're willing to research and look into it, and if you're willing to get out of your heart and out of your mind the resentments and the prejudices that stand between you and that source. Now, I'm sure long since you know what source I'm talking about. I have right before me a Bible, and this Bible is accepted by millions of people as being the Word of God. And by millions of others, it's ignored and rejected. Some want to take a part of it, maybe the New Testament. Others want to take only the Old. Others say, well, it's only the epistles of Paul. And others say, just believe the Gospels and the Psalms. And others say, forget the book of Revelation. And others say the epistle of James is an epistle of straw. They have all kinds of ideas. But let's get at the root of the whole question. Here's the point. If you can prove, and the Bible claims you can, scientifically, that there is a God, and his existence can be demonstrated, his mind, his personality, his warmth, his love, his mercy, his character can be demonstrated. I mean, scientifically you can prove this. And then you can substantiate that the Bible is the revealed word of that God. And then you find in the Bible instruction to man. Statements about what we're made of, approximately right down to the year when we were made, why we were made, statements about how we ought to live and why, so we can have the good things. Then a whole historical record of people who went the wrong way continually and who didn't serve God, who did not get busy and get in harmony with the natural physical laws that were put about them for their own good and protection. When you begin to discover these things, you're going to find, with a gasp of amazement, for example, that what you thought the Bible said, it doesn't say. And what you thought the Bible didn't say, it does say. You're going to find shock after shock when you look into the Bible, because let me tell you, there are millions of people who, even while they feel they are Christian people, now they admit that there may be a God. I know a lot of people accept both evolution and God. I don't know how they do it, but they do. And they never come to grips with what this really would do to them, as to whether or not they can stand a straddle or a stride of such a fence that is really so widely separated as the idea of a vast, unplanned, accidental, happenstance universe and gradual breaking of every known law and principle that there is to bring about a so-called evolution or divine creation. But there are people who try to accept both. I believe they call it theistic evolution. And there are people who believe that God is in us and God is everywhere. All kinds of ideas about a metaphysical dean or a sort of a spiritual tranquilizer into whose arms we creep in time of need. But get to the trunk of the tree and get the whole picture. Have you, regardless as to whether you are atheist, skeptic, agnostic, beatnik, dropout from society or school, have you, whether you are Christian, whether you are Catholic, Protestant, or Jew, whether you are a Muslim, I don't care what you are, have you ever thrown the whole thing up in the air? Ask yourself, where did you get what you believe? How did you come to believe it? What is the proof source? Can you substantiate it? Can you really prove it? Have you, if you feel you are a Christian and accept the Bible, ever really looked into it to study it and to find out what the gospel is all about and what it says? Is there a God? John Glenn, America's first astronaut, thinks there is. Werner von Braun, head of the space program, thinks there is. He says any universe is orderly and is absolutely dependable and as perfectly and intricately balanced and delicately ordered as this one. He said it had to have a maker. Scientist after scientist, I mean ornithologists, chemists, biologists, even geologists and paleontologists and astronomers believe there is a God. And yet many of these same men fail to take one more giant step and to look into his word and to find out what is his purpose. But they believe he exists. But can anyone prove it? Now millions of people assume you can't. They will tell you, why no, this is something you can't prove. I've even heard and read statements that leading theologians will tell people, no, I can't prove there is a God, they say. Well, I can, and God Almighty can prove it to you. And I mean proof, I mean scientific proof, I mean to where any other answer is utterly illogical, beyond belief, and to where the only scientific, the only honest, and the only logical answer is that God does exist. Now, I've begun a series on the World Tomorrow program of seven proofs that God exists, and I've begun clear back at the beginning just where evolution does in every first beginning paragraph of any textbook about where the universe came from. Now, first of all, you begin with the universe, then the solar system, then the Earth, then life upon it, and then the so-called orderly progression of evolution, of resident forces, natural causes, natural selection, all these words they use about life. But I've begun with the first one, and that is that wherever you look into the theories of evolution about the origin of the universe, you find energy, you find force, you find law, you find incredible power and force. There are the three ideas I gave you in the last program. The first one, the Big Bang Theory, which talks about a giant primeval atom, one huge atom of such proportions that it defies, of course, the human mind, and that it somehow exploded. And then the other is the steady state theory, and how they even use the very word. You'd think they're quoting the Bible. It says, in the beginning, quote, end quote. And that's not a quotation from the book of Genesis, that's a quotation out of the Big Bang theory. And then they talk about the steady state theory, and they say the universe had no beginning or no end. But in every one of these, including the oscillating universe idea, the spiral nebulae theory by Moulton, every last one of them, they begin with complex, dynamic law, force, and energy. And what, after all, is energy? What is force? What is electricity? What is magnetism? What is gravity? What is polarity? What is the gravitational field of the Earth and the Moon? What causes this? Why do iron filings act the way they do in front of a magnet? It's a fantastic thing when you stop to think of it. What is a law? Now, if you were an aerodynamic specialist, a designer of aircraft, you would know that you can depend utterly, and you can bet your life on law. And you know that law guides, controls, and acts upon everything that you must do. In effect, if you are designing an airplane wing, some kind of an air surface, it's like this new reentry vehicle they have that they're investigating to think about using in a space program, some way to glide into the Earth. It's a study of aerodynamics, about the operation of this Earth's atmosphere and its thinner and upper layers, and then its thicker, heavier, lower layers of air upon certain bodies and the shape of those bodies. And it's a discernible, measurable, observable, weighable, so to speak, law with which you can experiment, and you can come to know definite properties which you have to obey. Why? For your protection, for your good, for your success, to save and to preserve life. Now, my friends, these are physical laws I'm talking about. For the moment, we call them physical, and yet is any law physical? Is a law that affects minerals, a law that affects life and the reproduction of life, a law that affects your mind, the law that is causing you to hear my voice at this instant, the transmission of radio waves or of television waves through the air, is this a physical thing? Well, no, it's not. It's quite spiritual, because you can't see it. All you can do is to see how it operates. You cannot explain, and let me tell you, the first great proof, the great awesome proof, the all-encompassing proof, and it's one you must answer and have some other explanation for and admit to yourself, is that there cannot be a law, and you know it, without a lawgiver. There cannot be a law without a great, powerful originator and sustainer, and that's another part of it that I'm coming to later. Each one of these proofs overlap. But you can't have laws without a lawgiver. Now, for instance, we know that the Earth had a starting point, just like you did. Now, life is cyclical. Your life is the cycle of life, and I want to tell you about the future program that is in the sea. The food chain that is in the sea, the way it operates between the sun and the shifting cold and warm currents, all of the fantastic little sort of microbiological creatures, the little crustaceans and the tiny little animal forms upon which fish and birds feed, the chain of life that exists in the sea. It's a fantastic story all by itself. And how is it that we, human beings, depend upon the sea's depth and its temperatures and depend upon it as the receptacle of all human wastes and depend upon it for our weather and our very life when you get right down to it? Now, what about these life cycles? How did they begin? It's a matter of law. Nothing lives or dies to itself. It's, evolution uses the idea of the law, they call it, of the survival of the fittest. And they talk about certain things that are equipped to survive, how weeds will choke out good grass rather than the other way around, and how the stronger animals are going to survive. And why is it then, when you look into it, it's all in such delicate and perfect harmony? Why is it that bears have maybe one or two cubs, but rabbits have whole litters? Why is it that the creatures which are preyed upon are proliferating fantastically, and the creatures that are doing the preying upon have maybe one or two over vast distances of time? Why is it elephants that have no natural enemies at all except man have a far longer gestation period than many of these other creatures which are preyed upon, such as all the various gazelle types and the various animals in Africa that are preyed upon by all types of creatures, including man? How do you explain it? Oh, I know evolution claims to have certain excuses, but we'll get into those, and we'll get into them quite technically and yet in layman's language so you can understand them, and not in some difficult-to-believe technical two-bit monstrosities that people do not get. Now, you know, I know about some worms that never die. Not immortal worms, but worms that never die. You know which ones I mean? They're the kind of worms that turn into flies. In other words, these revolting-looking maggots you see in rotting vegetable or meat material once in a while. These worms never die. No, rather they turn into a fly. Now, that fly lays eggs. Those eggs become maggots. The maggots become flies. They grow up. They lay eggs. And on it goes. You can look at any kind of cycle of life you want to, whether it's the smiling, grinning porpoises in the sea. And by the way, an article is coming along, the next number of the Plain Truth magazine, on that subject that shows you why it is porpoises smile at the theory of evolution, why they have a grin for it, and why they have that humorous, warm, built-in smile on their face, and why they have such intelligence. Did you know, for example, that science believes that long ago fish slithered out of the seas, grew lungs and legs, walked upright, climbed trees, got disgusted with it all, and returned to the sea, discarded their legs, kept their lungs, grew fins instead, and became porpoises? Now, I imagine the average person really doesn't know that. If he did know it, he'd forgotten it. He read someplace, somewhere, in some paragraph in a book somewhere in high school about what evolution said. He was sort of bamboozled by it. After all, the man that wrote it had a doctor's degree, didn't he? So he accepted it. He thought, well, as a matter of fact, you're probably a little bit, uneducated and illiterate and ignorant if you don't believe it, because doesn't everybody who is anybody accept evolution? You're sort of subjected to some kind of pressure. But no, my friends, they don't have the answer. And these articles in the Plain Truth magazine every single month, they're going to show you they don't have the answer and show you where you can do further research to prove it to yourself. Now, life has a cyclical life character. Everything you know, from a sunset to the refraction of light through a diamond ring, from the habits of animals to the digestive system of a human being, from the function of your eyes to the listening of your ear, follows laws, and the more you look into them, the more complex, the more unbelievable, the more intricate, and the more awesome they are. And those laws had to have a lawgiver, and I tell you, that's one of the great proofs that there is a God, that he does live, and you can prove his existence. That's a proof. You can't deny it. You can't get around it. Science doesn't try. I have never yet seen a scientific textbook that tried to explain laws. I haven't. They assume, they accept, they take for granted the laws. They've got the laws. They talk about hot bodies exploding and then cooling. They've got the laws, the pressures, the forces, the heat, the light, the energy. But they never explain it. They ignore it. As one biologist said, the idea of life arising spontaneously on this earth in all of these intricate forms you see about you is precisely the same analogy. And frankly, this is the good one, but it still doesn't cover it. It's even more impossible than this. And this is impossible, by the way. And that is, he said, life happening accidentally is just exactly like the idea of an explosion in a print shop and the unabridged dictionary resulting from it. Now, you can't believe that. You just can't. It's about time you began to come to grips with it, because it's going to affect your life. And once you prove to yourself there is a God, and you prove his warmth and his love and his humor and his concern for you and his forgiveness and his long-suffering, and you prove what his purpose and his plan is, and you prove that the Bible is his word, then you're going to look into that Bible, and you're going to see that in it is the cause to marital happiness, the cause to physical health and well-being, the cause of peace, the cause that produces economic and financial prosperity, the cause that is going to give you everything you want. You farmers are going to have good crops, and you can depend on it. You parents are going to have healthy, obedient, respectful, bright-eyed, pink-cheeked, smiling, happy little children. And if you'll put this cause into action, you can expect the effect. You can depend upon it. It's a guarantee. Now, why do people have resentment against a book that is trying to give them everything they really want? You willing to look into it if you are right for this booklet? Does God exist? And the article that will come along, you don't need to mention it, it'll come along automatically, but just so you'll expect it. It's entitled, Seven Proofs God Exists. And I'm using it, that article, as a basis and a background for a series of programs on this subject, on the World Tomorrow program. Seven Proofs God Exists. It goes into the big yawning gaps, the big missing links in the evolutionary theory. And there are many and myriad of them. Does God exist? And then the other booklet on the proof of the Bible. Now, I haven't announced those a great deal for a long time, but we have them available. They're free of charge. Now, every single month in the Plain Truth magazine will be an article along these lines, in full color, illustrated, interesting, especially for children, really making it clear. In the current number is an article about the amazing migratory habits of birds. And also in the current number of the Plain Truth magazine, articles from behind the Iron Curtain, articles about world news and exactly what is happening in the light of Bible prophecy. Now, it's free of charge. There is no price. If you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Remember, the booklets and the articles I've announced are free of charge. The Plain Truth is free. There is no follow-up, no request for money for it. Write to the address, which will be repeated again in just a moment. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.